21 Elephants by Squishy Bees.
Twenty-one elephants.
Just try not to put into it.
Just
no, don't do that.
Pituitary gland. Pineapple. And vinegar.
Pentecostal. Oh, well. Welcome along to 21 Elephants, the podcast. My name is Spanky Moore, and my very, very good friend, Scotty Reeve, is sitting opposite me. Hello, Scotty. How are you?
Good.
Scotty's written a book. I own microphones, and when these two ideas come together, this is what we've got.
This is what we have in a cold room with a bookshelf and a deer head.
So we're sitting in my office. Heater's on.
Heater is dangerously close to a ream of paper.
Scotty's had a bunch of people over eating hummus and drinking red wine.
Mm.
That was your thank you party, wasn't it?
Yeah, thank you party to Christchurch book supporters.
Do you mind that I have a lozenge in my... I don't think it's going to ruin anything. I think it's going to be an endearing
part. You can have the lozenge. I mean, we should probably tell everyone that we're jacked up on... flu medicine that a friend of ours snuck back in from Africa. They were bright pink capsules, and we both have some kind of a cold.
Anyway, tell me a story. What do you got for me today?
A few years ago, when I was about 21, 22, I moved into this place called The Goat Shed. And it was called The Goat Shed for a number of reasons, but one of those was because it had a great lineage of actual goats who lived there along the way. So I think the first of those was Clarence, and he fell into a hole and choked on pizza boxes, apparently. That was before I was around. Second one, I think called Casper, he retired to the East Coast. I don't really know what's going on there. But we got a third one while I was there. His name was Clarence Thomas II. We had him for 3 days, and he had a great 3 days. We've got photos of him with a packet of nachos on his head running through the lounge. It was just a great time. And then one morning we went out to feed him, and we just saw that his leash was just pulled tight over this fence. He'd kind of tried to jump over the fence, not realizing it was a lot lower on the other side, and had hung himself. So he had a wild 3 days with us, and then just said, "You know what, that was so good, I'm out. Go hard or go home, Clarence."
You can't say that, but it is pretty funny. Because goats are like that.
Yeah, we got this goat, but we didn't really know what to do with him. Nobody really wanted to dig a hole, so we just laid out a tarp in the basement, and we just put him on the tarp. And then it was the dishes, we just forgot about him for 2 or 3 weeks. And then we went down there, and we're like, we've got to move him out. So we dug a hole, but this was 3 weeks later, so he's pretty ripe and bloated, and...
Full of nachos.
Yeah. we lift up this tarp, and just all this red and yellow goo rolls off it. So anyway, we did have a little bit of a funeral for him. We buried him in this hole out back of the goat shed.
Wait, were you renting?
Yeah, we were renting. Yeah. Total slumlord. And we throw this goat in the hole, we bury him, we put a lemon tree on top of it. The lemon tree dies about a week later too. So again, typical lemon tree move. So this was just what the goat shed was like. That's where it got its name. But it was this place in every way barely suitable for human occupation. Had a couch that covered a hole that went through the wall to the outside. So you get a couch-shaped outline of black mould against the wall. But one of the great things about the goat shed is there were about 7 or 8 of us guys who lived there, and it accidentally became this brotherhood. And we would just never close our front door. And what happened when we stopped closing our front door is that people would just roll in, and we'd host a big roast meal for our neighbourhood on a Friday night, and we might have 30 or 40 people turn up. And there's this one Sunday night where we've just finished up this meal, and we're all sitting around having a cup of tea and just hanging out and going, oh, you know, what a great night. And in comes this guy through the front door, and he's got like greasy long hair, and he's dressed head to toe in leather and wearing like a Megadeth t-shirt. And he just walks into our lounge. We've never seen him before. And he just sits down on a couch without saying anything. And we all sort of look at each other and trying to see if he's anyone's friend, but no one knows. And then he gets up and he looks at all of us and he says, "My name is Satan. And I have come here to case out your house, and tomorrow I will return and steal everything." And we're all just looking around. We're like, what do we do? And so I sort of said the only thing that I sort of could think to say. I said, "Well, Satan, would you like a cup of tea?" He said, "Oh, that would be very nice." So we grabbed him a cup of tea and a ginger nut, and then we sat around, and over the next kind of hour or two, he would share these stories of drug-induced spiritual transcendence on African flu medication. And
much like we're enjoying now.
And he'd get up on our coffee table and just play air guitar for a while and talk about how he was the world air guitar champion. And it just went on and on and on. And then eventually he just stood up and then left. That was that. And we kind of didn't realise until a few years later that I think he actually thought he was in the drug house next door to us. But anyway, the goat shed was this place where we just had this open door, and it just became this rich life that just introduced us to this whole different world. And, you know, we'd have these moments. I remember one night where we'd accidentally scheduled some party on the same night as a big rugby fixture. And we're like, well, we can't really miss it. So we just nailed boards to the front of the house and put a projector out on the pavement and had, you know, 40, 50 neighborhood people just rolled around sitting on the fence out front of our place watching the rugby together. And it was just this rich thing where those barriers between mine and yours and between the front door and our house and our neighbourhood were disintegrating in this weird kind of beautiful accident.
Community feels like a word that has been thrashed and kind of put on some sort of pedestal. And yeah, I mean, it's hard to find anyone who doesn't think that community is a good idea.
Yeah. Often what we talk about in the church when we talk about community is just being closer to the people around us who are just like us. But when you look at who Jesus pulls together in his 12, you know, he's got freedom fighters who want to kill the ruling establishment alongside tax collectors. He's got people with anger management problems. And so he pulls together this crew who are unlike one another. And, you know, it would be similar to pulling together a church leadership where, you know, you have an ACT Party veteran voter and a Green Party lefty from Cuba Street in Wellington. And he says, well, actually, this new way I'm inviting you into is so big that you two can journey together around it. And so I think often when we talk about community, we're actually talking about a pseudo community where we actually continue to live our lives with people who are just like us, whereas what we see in the scriptures is this narrative, this arc of always God widening the categories of who's in and who's out and disintegrating them. So really, I think when we talk about community, we're talking about disintegrating those barriers that exist between us and the stranger.
So I mean, there's a difference, I guess, between cheap community and what you're saying is more costly community. Because, I mean, a lot of people are lonely, and their most exciting idea of community is having 10 friends that they get on with most of the time, they're not too annoying, and they play board games with. It's not what you're saying here, is it?
I grew up in a, you know, white Pākehā middle class suburb, and I went along to this high school, and there was a family who went to this high school, and they were known as the bad kids from the bad area. Everyone just knew it. Everyone knew we weren't supposed to hang out with those kids. I don't ever remember my parents taking me aside and saying, don't hang out with these guys. But it's only now, a few years later, looking back on it, when I realise, they were the only Māori kids in our class. That it was totally a racially motivated thing. And there was this thing that I think is built in and wired into so many of us from a young age to sense this otherness and it being somehow unsafe. So we group ourselves into neighbourhoods with people just like us. We go to schools with people just like us. We go to churches with people just like us. But we miss out on the image of God revealed in people who are quite different from us, which I think is what God calls us to.
God, that takes... It takes a crap load of patience. I don't know many people patient enough to have the time. I just think of your story. To have the time to not just leave your door open, that seems a bit unsafe. But then when Satan turns up, to have the time to offer some idiot a cup of tea and let him play ear guitar on my table and to take him seriously and to go, this guy's created in the image of God. What can I see here? I just don't know many Christians with that sort of time, resolve, patience, discernment. It's different than, Derek's turned up. I like Derek.
Yeah.
We're going to eat our kebabs together and watch the rugby. How did you come to that place that you could look at Satan and go, not unfortunate name, how you could look at Satan and go, we're not just going to evict him? Because that would have been my response. All right, mate. Out you go.
There's probably something that changed in my heart around that time where I started to realise that it wasn't so much that the last, the lost, the lonely, however you want to form those categories, that they needed me to come and bring Jesus to them, but that actually the people who were on the edges and the people who were nothing like me actually held a part of the image of God that I didn't.
But that's where it turns, right, is realising you're not there to just straight out be better,
yeah,
make a neighborhood better, but to actually learn something from wherever you find yourself.
Yeah, totally. It's the belief that in our insulation within our culture and within our social group that we're actually just seeing the thinnest slither of what Christ and what God is like. So it's a learning experience for us that we actually believe that the more diverse the communities we're hanging out in, the more of God we're seeing. I'd be lying if I didn't say that as, you know, a 20, 21-year-old, I didn't think I was going in with some kind of a sense that I was going to save the day. But I think quite quickly you realise that you're incapable for any of these situations, and whatever you thought you had to bring, you're well out of your depth.
Yeah.
And then it becomes, well, where is God in this? And so I think that's the thing there. We can either live from this position of fear where we believe that anything different or anything slightly dangerous is somehow going to compromise or undo our faith, or we actually see that as an opportunity for deepening faith. And not an opportunity for us to change the world, but for us to be changed and to have our hearts changed.
Community with the people who you normally wouldn't hang out with busts that wide open. I mean, that's the move, right? A realization, yep, that it's not around who's in and out. It's a realization that there's a hell of a lot to be learnt from the people who you would never hang out with.
Absolutely. There's a quote in the book from an Aboriginal leader, Lil Watson, and she says, if you have come to help me, you're wasting your time. But if you have come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together. And that's the thing, like, our liberation is bound up together. I think we are, as, you know, middle-class Westerners, we are invited to a liberation away from the illusion of how good and how capable we think we are. And we may be able to bring some money, or we may be able to bring some privilege or some connection that may help some people.
Broadband.
Yeah, we may have some things to bring, but actually what's brought to us is liberation away from the monsters we could become if someone doesn't awaken us from our sense of superiority.
The kind of community you're talking about is basically one that kicks your ass. You know how hospitality used to mean, back in the old days, was actually the idea that you had to give food to a stranger, that hospitals came from the idea that you actually had to tend to the sick, who, you know, Christians tended to the sick. Hospices were where Christians tended to the dying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But now good hospitality is when you have your friends around and you cook a really nice meal.
Yeah, or it's nice an industry.
Yeah. Or it's an industry. You pay through the note. You are talking around hospitality in that first sense.
What we're talking about is costly hospitality,
which is abysmal. I mean, it's not a good time, is it? Well, you're saying it is, but not really.
I don't think any of it's any of that stuff that Jesus initially calls us to is ever comfortable when we go to it. But something changes in us as we do it, eh?
If we can bring ourselves to get past the first road bump, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what you're saying is that if you want to go on the journey of discovering a more radical Jesus, you can't do that sitting by yourself You can't do that by listening to a bunch of podcasts.
You can't do it by listening to a bunch of podcasts. You can't do it in a life group. You can't do it turning up to church on Sunday. You have to like intentionally break down some of these barriers that you've set up in your life to people who are unlike you, and actually choose to begin to want to see Jesus in places you didn't believe he could be before.
What's the rule of thumb for not just wanting to consume exotic varieties of poor people?
Yeah. I mean, I think when we start on any of these journeys, we are always probably doing a lot less good than we think we are. You know, it's like the 16-year-old going on his mission trip to Fiji or whatever. Like, there is a thing of a kind of tokenism to that often. But I think it's often through some of those experiences that we kind of realise our own incapability and
You sort of have to be brought to your own limits, don't you? You have to be brought to your knees. You have to realise that you're not quite the saviour you thought you were.
You know, there's a difference between charity and community. You know, there's a difference between us going out there and feeling really good about something that we think we offer. And then there's this idea, like, let's genuinely bridge the divide. I think anything actually meaningful, any kind of meaningful community, is going to be where there is an experience of, like, humiliation for us, where there's an exchange of power. So we lose some of our kind of white privileged power and are forced into a situation where we have to feel a bunch of stuff we haven't had to feel before.
So let me just mirror back what I just heard you say. Because that's a pretty articulate, if not confronting, idea, that real community that begins to shape you involves the path of humiliation.
Yeah, I think so.
Because that isn't what most young people I talk to who long for community think they are wanting in on. There's a house that I'm involved with that does kind of accommodation for students. So it's not by any means like a radical community. It's one just attached to a local church. But still, idea being people who are studying at the local university can go and stay together. And I remember having a conversation with one guy that said, I really think what I need is some community. He was living by himself. He said, I really think I need, it'd be good for me. That was his thing. It's going to be good for me living with these people. 3 months later, I was having another conversation where he said, you don't know what it's like to live with these people. And I said, but you said you wanted community. He said, yes, but not these people.
Yeah. Yeah.
I need some other people. And I said to him, I'm just pretty sure this is what it means to live in community.
Yeah.
You come to kind of loathe the people you're with. And the question is, can you move past that stage? That's what the path is, right? You're saying even more so, though. It's a path of humiliation.
Yeah, I mean, but I have a friend who says, give yourself to a cause that will test the quality of your love. And so I think the thing is we're expecting that as we lean into community and into hospitality, not as an industry, but as like a holy call, that actually our love will be revealed to be wanting. And as loving or as compassionate or as generous as we thought we were, or the saviors we thought we were, all those illusions come crumbling down. And I think the thing is we go in not expecting community to be this like incredible thing, but for it to just be life and for there to be disagreement and for, you know, sometimes someone steals your stuff or, you know, people don't do the dishes or whatever. And, you know, it was interesting. A couple of years ago, I was at a conference and I met a guy who knew Henri Nguyen. And I was like, oh, man, Henri Nguyen, he's just amazing, you know. And he's like, yeah, he is amazing. And then he paused and he's like, but he was useless at the dishes. And I just kind of love that, you know, because Henri Nguyen is like this kind of hero for community. But in the end, you know, I mean, I don't know how that guy, you know, recast it in his mind, but apparently Henri Nguyen sucked at the dishes.
Yep, and that was the main thing he wanted to... Oh, yeah, he's written some interesting books, but let me tell you.
He was bad at the dishes.
Spinach left on the plate.
You need to know that, yeah, all his books, who cares,
and I
bad
guess
at the dishes.
That is part of the thing of, because we have the default setting now is that we live relatively self-determined, isolated lives, community is just a whole bunch of people's issues banging up against each other.
Yeah, well, I think what you're kind of saying is that when it gets hard, we double down.
And so, you know, we live in this community with about 10 of us in Wellington over two houses. And I think the thing is, you know, I've been in flats before, but with a flat, you know, it might almost, you know, always know it will bust up at the end of the year.
And you can hide in your room. Hey, there's always a flatmate.
Yeah, yeah. So if someone pisses you off, just tolerate them until December and then it's over. But when you go, okay, we're going to have a series of commitments together. We're going to pray together. We're going to say that no conflict is allowed to go unresolved. We're going to eat together. We're not going to have things in the fridge with our names on them. You know, we're actually going to like try to recreate family with this crew of people from different value systems and different upbringings and different experiences.
This is a bad idea. It's not going to work.
It's a horrible idea.
It's never going to work.
And so then you hit those moments of conflict and you go, all right, well, I'm pretty sure we all plan to be here for a while. So we'll just double down. We'll just have to talk about it. And we'll just have to work through it. And I'll have to find a way to love you, and you'll have to find a way to love me.
Which is fine until it's your issue that gets pushed on. Do you know what I mean? Like, because when everyone else is spinning the dummy over stupid, menial crap, it's okay, even though it's not. You know, you can take the moral high ground. But when they push your buttons, it's hard, isn't it? And it's embarrassing when you show what you are.
Absolutely. And I think, again, this is that thing where community reveals in us that which we didn't want to know about ourselves. I remember our first year in our community at the moment, we were having this conversation about vulnerability one night, about seven or eight of us. And I don't know what happened, but one of these guys just really hit on a nerve for me. And before I could realize what was happening, I had like got out of my chair and was standing over him, fists clenched, just screaming at this guy.
Yeah.
It's not something I would ever do, you know? But this, like, this crucible of community just awoke something in me that when you're in your kind of well-adjusted climate-controlled environments, you can still believe that you're generally a pretty good person.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then you actually allow people, you know, it says in the scriptures, as iron sharpens iron, one man sharpens another. Well, I don't think iron sharpening iron is a very, like, you know, a very non-abrasive thing.
It's not good for either piece of iron.
So it's flying off sparks and shards of metal. That's a pretty aggressive imagery. And so what we're saying is that for us to be shaped into the character of Christ, we have to do things in community because that's what reveals in us how much we lack the character of Christ.
It takes a real commitment to say, I'm going to live in that way.
I think the thing is, in the Western world, we have become so individualistic and so transactional in our relationships that it's like we've been in the lukewarm water for so long that when we go back to this thing of what Christ called us to, it's like scalding hot by comparison.
Yeah.
One of the images we talk about a bunch is that Russian icon, I think, by Rublev, which has, you know, the three persons. Is it right behind me?
I was going to say, if you pull that curtain, how holy is this? You pull the curtain. Oh, there it is.
It's right there.
It's just behind the curtain.
It's right there.
Who would have thought?
I honestly didn't see that.
You know, it's one of my techniques is rather than living in community myself, I just have that painting.
Oh, yeah. That's good.
Much easier.
That I imagine it would be.
The guy on the left snorts cocaine sometimes, but other than that, it's been a great relationship.
I think you just said the Holy Spirit snorts cocaine sometimes.
I take that back.
Anyway, all right. So this icon by Rublev, I think it's like 15th century or something like that.
He's a Russian painter guy. Is it one of the ones you say you'd probably know it if you saw it?
You'd know it if you saw it.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. And so what it's got is it's got the three persons of the Godhead sitting around this table, and the side of the table facing you is empty. And the idea they reckon here with this icon is that you're being invited to the table, that this perfect community that exists between the three persons of God, we're invited to join in on. And I think we are asked to extend that same thing again too. So it's like we're invited to the table, but then we widen the table, you know, we open our tables again, and on it goes, and everybody's invited into this kind of like perfect community.
And to hit pause on that, because people talk all sorts of theological crap all the time that other people hear and go, oh, that sounds like a neat idea.
Mm.
What we're saying is that if at the very center of the universe is not a God, but a triune God,
a
God in community,
yeah.
And out of that everything was created, so that somehow the DNA of the universe is somehow a community relation. One common thing the universe might have in relation to each other is that it's in relationship somehow. That's quite significant. That's a significant Christian understanding of the universe.
Yeah, totally.
I was just hitting pause, you know what I mean?
It's like
a freaking painting too. It's like, if this is true, it's like quite a significant insight around what it means to be a human.
Yeah.
Go on.
Yeah, and so this grace which is extended to us to come and join God at the table is the grace we extend. And that's why Jesus says, the world will know you by the love you have for one another.
Mm.
That the church at its essence is a table reflecting that greatest table. And if there is no love between us, if we don't have genuine community together, then we actually have nothing to offer the world. So that's the thing. When we come together, it's not even about going to the poor neighbourhoods or, you know, any of that kind of poverty tourism stuff. It's about even just us in the church really getting around the table together in a way that's actually costly to our finances, to our independence, to our reputation, to all of that kind of thing.
Well, and if you look at the commandments of Jesus, in many of our traditions, in many of our churches, we seem to have ignored his emphasis on they'll know you by the love you have for one another.
Mm.
And I don't think we've done much exploration around what it would take to really love each other. Yeah, and it's easier to love each other if you only see each other once a week, too.
Yeah.
To love each other for the scoundrels and the mongrels that we are.
Mm.
But I feel like I get that both of these are true in terms of a Christian understanding of why we would bother with community.
Mm.
That in one sense, it's a redemptive forming place. In another sense, it's just the DNA. It's the most natural DNA of the universe.
Mm. Mm.
But it feels like in many of the people who engage in intentional community stuff, it's much more heroic. It's something that you see people, they opt in for a year, maybe two, it becomes too hot, they retreat.
And isn't it, though, just the kind of the hubris of, like, being young that we think that when we go on our short-term mission trip, we actually change the place we go to. In the end, that kind of saviour mentality has to break down. And if it doesn't break down, then we'll just be gutted that we weren't the heroic saviours we thought we were. And then we'll kind of leave with our tail between our legs.
You're either brought to a place of genuine humility or you're humiliated. And you bail.
This thing of community is like essential 101 discipleship that, like, you actually can't get to following Jesus and being shaped into the person of Jesus just by reading your scriptures and going along to home group. That you actually need these things. So you've got two things, really, with the stuff of community. You've got what it does for, you've got the home of hospitality that it might offer to the place you live. You have that. But then you have the crucible of formation, which is revealing those things in us that don't look like Jesus. So I think it's a two-pronged thing.
Mm. So you're saying you really question how far someone can be formed as a follower of Jesus if it's a solo sport?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think everybody needs to live together, but I think everybody needs to do costly community together.
How do you know if you're doing costly community?
Because it hurts, I think. If you're not loving your neighbour in a way that hurts, whether it hurts your bank balance, you're like, oh, I really didn't want to have to bail them out of that debt or whatever, you know, or oh, I really did not want to befriend that guy who would rip me off. Or you know what? Actually, it was really inconvenient when they called me up saying they needed something. Like, it's moving against all those Western impulses of efficiency and comfort and having, you know, everything controlled the way that we want it to be. If it hurts because you're losing control, then we're actually in the territory, I think, of the community that Jesus talked about. But if what it is just having a shared lunch, you know, every three Sundays or something like that, you know, and we talk about the shallow things of our lives, then it's not really costly to us, and so we're not being shaped by it.
Yeah. I think when we talk around cost too, I think we sometimes are trivial around the risks that are involved in trying to engage in community when no one's done it in a long time. Because, I mean, I tried something a few years ago and ended up, one of my dearest friends, the relationship just broke down.
Mm.
We're just not friends anymore.
Mm.
And I think it's like one of the deepest griefs of my life is losing that friendship.
Mm.
Because they don't die. I think that, you know, if someone had died, you can grieve it.
Mm.
When it's a point in time, I don't know. It's taken me years to realise how deep that grief is. And then, if we hadn't tried, we'd probably still be friends.
Mm.
And I think maybe that's some of the stuff that comes back to the Trinitarian thing. As if I think that we didn't have a choice but to try, maybe I can say, oh, well, it's trying.
Mm.
But, you know, a bunch of people with enough ideology throw themselves into the meat grinder together.
Mm.
It's a big risk if you're not on the same page around how much pain you're willing to endure.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
The thing is, you need to practice at it.
Mm. Yeah, and I think, I can't remember who said it, but there was someone who said a few years ago, you know, those who love community kill community.
That was old, that was Bonhoeffer, I think.
Was it?
Yeah. And Life Together, I think he said that.
Yeah, and so I think the thing is,
don't worry, I just heard the quote before. I haven't read the book.
if the goal is community, yeah. You know, if the goal is for us to live in a house together, or the goal is for us to write the next Irresistible Revolution, you know, and just hang together long enough to get the good stories. You know, if we have this kind of heroic idea in our head of this life we're going to live together, if that's the goal, it will fall apart because it's kind of ego-driven still in the end, right?
And so I think, what do you need then? Because some people say you need a shared mission and some people might say you just need to love each other. What do you think?
Well, we sat down with a good friend of ours at the start of the year, and she would have been doing community for about 20-25 years, and we were talking to her about some of the difficult situations that we'd had between one another and in our community, and she said, you need to remember that in the end all you can offer anyone is Jesus and community. That's all you've got to give them. You know, you can't rescue anyone. All you've got is your commitment to Jesus and your commitment to one another. And so I think as corny and as cliche as it sounds, like, if we don't come together around Jesus, then we kind of got nothing.
And that's where you do see a bunch of things stumble around and lose their way, is when it's only about community.
Yeah.
So you haven't even got, a shared mission. You haven't even got Jesus really in common. Like, Jesus has sort of been deconstructed into something else.
Or if Jesus has just become your, like, social ideology leader.
Yeah,
for community.
That blows out pretty quick, eh?
Mm. And it is that thing of, you know, what we talked about, that where this all stems from when we're at our best and we think about what it's really about is that table that Father, Son and Holy Spirit invite us to. And if we're all going back to that table daily, then we can continue to open our table. But if the opening of our table is about our own heroism or our own need to feel like a good person or to do charity or something like that, it won't be enough, because in the end, the people you think you're supporting or trying to help, like, you'll become too annoying to them and they'll become too annoying to you. And at that point, unless there is that higher table that you are being called to, you can't do that for long. It's just not possible. Nobody's that good a person.
Hey, so some people have been sending in questions about the book, which is great. Recording them, sending them in.
Kia ora, this is Scotty Reeve. I'm not available at the moment, but if you would like to get hold of me, I would prefer you do that by text or by email. Thanks.
At the tone, record your message.
Hey, I'm Dane. My wife and I are living in Hastings with our three young children. We have a somewhat open home and believe strongly in building community and in living and loving sacrificially. The question we have faced with having people share our home is this. If things aren't working well, what things would you be looking for to identify whether or not to continue to support people within your own home?
It's a cool question. We've had all sorts of different people live in the different homes we've lived in over the last few years, and there definitely have been like a huge number of times where those things just don't work out, where your stuff gets stolen or your things get smashed up or like, you know, to a lesser extent, that like people just like don't respect you. Like what I'd say to Dane and to people who are inviting people with like big stuff going on to live with them, probably one of the first questions you want to ask yourself is what you're expecting from that. Like, are you expecting that by them living with you, everything will come up roses? Is that kind of your hope for this? Because if that's what you're kind of hoping, you probably need to lower your expectation, that there is just going to be some situations where it doesn't work out at all. The second thing you want to think about is all we actually have to offer is the community that we are in God. And so to any family or to any community, there are actually ways of doing things and there are customs and there is a culture. And that is actually what we offer to people, is being able to come into a safe space. And so if we actually like compromise that culture, or we let it slip in order to accommodate someone who's having a rough time, then what we can actually end up doing is undermining the very thing that is meant to serve them, which is a place of safety and family and love. So I think it's really important that actually if people are coming in, like, it's okay for there to be expectations that they buy into to be a part of that community and to be a part of that home. I also think like it's really important that our relationships, to be genuine relationships, have to be mutual. So if the case is that it's us giving everything and someone consuming us, or vice versa, any relationship which is just one person being consumed is not a genuine relationship. So actually I think that, like, you know, if people are coming to live with us for a time, then they come into the culture of the house that we're in, but they also come in willing to cook some food, willing to do the dishes, willing to participate mutually in the life of this community. And so, like, if we've had people come and stay with us long term, the expectation is that at 6:15 they join us for prayers, because that's what this family does. So I don't think it's wrong, and in fact I think it's essential that we have expectations of the people who come to stay with us. But the final question, or the final thought that I'd have for this question, is that it's not always the best thing for the people that you're journeying with who are struggling to come and live with you. And sometimes we can want to do that out of some like desire to show like sacrificial love, but actually sometimes our relationships and our ability to journey with people long term can be better when we don't have to see each other all the time. And sometimes it's easier for that person to walk into our house and have a really great evening having dinner with us, and then be able to leave and to have a few great dinners, rather than to kind of do the warts and all community journey together. And so I think the other thing is too, when those things don't work out, then sometimes maybe you were the only connection that house to faith or to compassion, and then you lose that when the living situation doesn't work out. So I think it is not the only way for us to be community and to be the family of God to people. So I think those are some thoughts you might want to think about, and thanks for your question, Dane.
All right, and that is us for this episode of the 21 Elephants podcast. Scotty, it's been great talking to you today.
So much fun.
Check out our podcast feed for more podcasts as we do them. If you want to get the book, where do you get it from?
You can get the book from 21elephants.co. That's 21, the numbers, elephants.co.
And you can get it on Kindle as well as physical. Is
yeah,
right?
You can get that from amazon.com.
And a big thanks to Renee Corbett, who's in Berlin, and Dave Thompson.
Thanks, Dave,
for supplying us with the amazing theme song.
Great work.
Oh, it's good.